you.
Okay, so yes, I wanted to say something about turbulence in planet formation, and I'm going to try not to assume anything, but I probably will, so, you know, obviously interrupt and so on. So I want to begin with some background, just generally discussing where turbulence probably plays a role in planet formation and the aspects of it which we would sort of be most interested to understand better in order to understand planet formation. So that's going to be very general, and you know we can sort of expand that section, you know, if you want. So I've just thrown a few slides together, but we can certainly say more about that. Then sort of as we have time, I want to say something about some work we've been doing trying to understand one aspect of turbulence in disks around stars. These are MHD simulations of turbulent protoplanetary disks where, you know, we think planets might be forming. And I particularly want to emphasize some results that we've sort of been looking at recently that we really don't understand, but which maybe have some importance for planet formation. So maybe to start with some background, some sort of numbers. What is the environment for planet formation? Well, it's disks of gas and dust that are seen to be orbiting young stars, okay, young stars forming in the galaxy today. So here on the right is an image of such a disk. So this is the Hubble Space Telescope. This is actually the Orion Nebula. So this is a, you know, region you can see almost with the naked eye, certainly with small binoculars. So what you've got here is a young star. The bright background is the glowing gas of the Orion Nebula, and then this dark oval here is the protoplanetary disk. And this is sort of symptomatic of sort of what the quality of the observations are. In terms of resolution, it's very hard to resolve these systems, so you don't see very much. So the sort of typical scales you're thinking about are sort of the scales of the solar system, 100 AU. 1 AU is the distance between the Earth and the Sun, so maybe 10 to the 15 centimeters across. The masses that you're looking at are generally a small fraction of the mass in the star, so between maybe a thousandth and a tenth of the mass of the star. And so if you put those together, you get densities that are maybe 10 to the minus 9 grams per cubic centimeter, fairly close to the star, declining by several orders of magnitude as you go further out. Similarly, the temperature drops close to the star. You might be thinking of 1,000 Kelvin or a couple of thousand Kelvin for the temperature, so at least the alkali metals would be ionized that close to the star. If you go really far out, you're getting more to the sort of background temperature in the interstellar medium, which might be 20 Kelvin or thereabouts. And observationally, the lifetime of these systems is a few million years, roughly speaking. So that's going to correspond to maybe 1,000 dynamical times, 1,000 orbital times at the outside, 10 to the 7 dynamical times, or more than that, very close to the star. And most of this is gas, so most of it's hydrogen and helium. There's dust and condensable solids that make up about 1% by mass for solar composition. And the basic dynamical state is, you know, you're living for millions of years, millions of dynamical times. So we think in the vertical direction, so if you're sort of, it's an orbital plane and then a vertical direction away from that, we're going to be in hydrostatic equilibrium. So there'll be some scale height h, which is going to be the sound speed divided by the angular velocity. Observationally, that number is about 5% or something like that. And then in the radial direction, there's a balance between radial gravity and rotation, and there's a correction due to pressure gradients that's order h over r squared, which is therefore, you know, pretty small.
Well, this parameter somehow time dependent during the lifetime. How strong is it time dependent? Like temperature, percentage of solid fraction?
So the temperature is relatively stable because the temperature is substantially governed by the radiation from the star. Okay. The density and the mass are both going to go down a lot, you know, maybe two orders of magnitude, something like that, over the lifetime.
Because of what? Of accretion?
Because of accretion, also perhaps because some of the material is being blown away, is being heated and just coming off as a wind. We really don't know how variable the condensable fraction is. We know that dust is present even at late times, but you know, dust has a huge opacity, so even a very small amount, you would still be optically thick, you'd still see it. So why does turbulence matter in these systems? Well, there are sort of two independent aspects of turbulence that we're sort of interested in. So one is as a source of angular momentum transport within the gas itself. So we don't care at this moment about the dust or the solid composition. And the point here is simply that the specific angular momentum of the flow, you know, there's not very much mass in the disk, so most of the potential is just from the central star. The specific angular momentum is an increasing function of radius. So if you want to take that material in the disk and accrete it onto the star, it obviously has to lose angular momentum. So it either has to redistribute angular momentum within the gas, or it has to be lost entirely in some kind of wind. And you can estimate how strong the viscosity is due to just collisions of hydrogen molecules in the disk, and work out an evolution time from that. And the evolution time is extremely long. It's much longer than the age of the universe. So from the fact that the disks are evolving, seem to be evolving, gas is flowing on, clearly it's not because the disk is viscous due to collisions between hydrogen molecules. So it's generally assumed that you have a very large effective viscosity that is a byproduct of having turbulence within the disk. And so therefore you're able to redistribute angular momentum much more efficiently than if in fact you were just talking about these microscopic processes.
I don't think this thermal
Okay, kinematic viscosity here. Yeah. Yeah.
What about compressibility?
In what?
Strongly compressed.
So we'll sort of come to that. The Mach number of the flow is very high. So it's like 20 or something like that. But we think the perturbations are subsonic. So mildly compressible situation probably is the one that is prevailing. So on the scale of the disk, you can treat it as a fluid. When you think about how it interacts with the particles, then it's a rarefied gas. Well, it's depending on the particle size, but when you think about dust, for example, it's going to be small. Dust is going to be small compared to the dust is going to be small compared to the mean free path for sure. The mean free path at 1 AU might be a few centimeters, something like that. So then the second aspect of turbulence we're interested in is how it will affect small particles mostly, also large particles to some extent, but mostly small particles. And one way of thinking about this is to think, well, what would happen if the fluid was not turbulent at all, it was just a laminar flow. So in that case, if you consider dust particles, which have maybe fallen into the disk from the interstellar medium, those will have an unbalanced component of vertical gravity, and so they will tend to settle towards the disk midplane. So we're on a scale that's small compared to the mean free path, so in the Epstein regime of drag. So the drag force would be given by this expression. So A would be the particle size, V would be its velocity relative to the gas, and this would be the thermal speed of the particles within the gas, rho is the gas density here. So you have to balance that against the vertical component of gravity, and you end up with a settling velocity, which is just linear in the particle size and depends on how high you are away from the disk midplane. And this is already, in terms of speed, this would be maybe a tenth of a centimeter per second, something like that. But this already gives you a fairly short time scale for micron-sized dust particles to settle out of the disk. It's about 10 to the 5 years at 1 AU. However, this actually is an overestimate of how quickly things would be expected to happen. Because if you're thinking about just micron-sized dust particles that are colliding with each other at sub-centimeter per second velocities, there's basically no doubt that those would stick together just by surface forces. And so then the particles get bigger, the settling velocity also goes up, and everything kind of runs away. And that's what's plotted here. This is time in years, this is particle size, and this is height of particles. And the point to note is that actually whatever particle size you start with, everything grows and settles quite quickly, and the time scale here is more like 1,000 years. So if you purely had a laminar flow, everything would settle out really quite quickly. So turbulence could sort of do, or there could be two kinds of turbulence that could be important. So one possibility, the one that is, I would say, most considered, is let's say that the gas itself is intrinsically turbulent. So it would be turbulent even if there were no particles there. So in that case, the turbulence will tend to inhibit this settling. It will produce some diffusion, which will stop, in fact, the particles settling into a very thin layer. And in addition to sort of preventing settling vertically, it will also mix particles radially through the disk. And this radial mixing is sort of quite interesting because there are some observations of that. So there was a NASA mission called Stardust a few years back, which recovered samples from the tail of a comet. Okay, so what they actually did is they had a block of aerogel, and the particles came in and were sort of slowed down relatively gently by this aerogel and decelerated. Then the samples were brought back to Earth and analyzed in the lab. And what was found there was that comets are basically icy objects, so they are formed far out in the solar system. But some of these particles that were captured were crystalline silicate material, which appeared to have been annealed at very high temperatures, 1,000 degrees Kelvin or thereabouts. So there was some evidence from this that in the solar system, there was actually transport of high temperature processed material right out to the comet forming region, sort of where Neptune and Pluto are now. So one possibility, which actually we've been looking at, is what's happened here is simply that you had enough turbulence in the disk that you were able to mix the material really very readily with radius. It turns out that's actually quite hard because the gas overall is flowing inwards, so it has some bulk inflow. So the turbulence has to not just mix, it also has to overcome just the net inflow. So it requires quite unusual conditions for that to actually work, but it's sort of interesting. Then the other possibility is, suppose that the disk is not intrinsically turbulent, so it basically has at least a low level of turbulence. Well, in that case, the particles, which initially are just 1% of the gas by volume, by density, would eventually settle to the point where their density starts to rival or exceed the gas density. And so at that point, there can be new fluid instabilities setting in, which are intrinsically due to this aerodynamic coupling between the particles and the gas. And there's been a lot of work on this recently. These are often called streaming instabilities. Here's an example from Bayan Stone. So this would be radius, and this would be height here. These are just two different choices of parameters. So for example, what size particles you get. And so what's happening here is that they're imagining that the particles have settled so much that they have a sort of comparable density to the gas, and then getting these linear instabilities setting in, which are producing this very filamentary structure here in the particles. And so one idea is that this kind of instability might be a way to actually concentrate the particles further. So you sort of concentrate them by a factor of 100 by vertical settling, then this instability sets in, you concentrate them much more due to the instability, and then maybe gravity sets in and actually collapses, sort of clumps within this particle turbulence into larger bodies. So one idea is that this is essential for going from maybe centimeter-sized objects up to kilometer-sized objects, and that's a big open question in planet formation, how that takes place. But you can see there's considerable complexity here because these kind of calculations were done without the intrinsic turbulence. If you add in the intrinsic turbulence, it's not even obvious that the particles will settle enough that you could produce these two fluid instabilities in the first place. So there's sort of a trade-off there. So the sort of questions that we might be interested in then are obviously, what are the sources of intrinsic turbulence? From the point of view of the evolution of the disk, the main question we would like to ask is, how efficient is that at transporting angular momentum? And is that angular momentum transport due to fluid stresses, or is it due to magnetic stresses? So those are certainly important questions. And I guess more generally, is it actually redistribution of angular momentum due to turbulence, or is it actually loss of angular momentum in a wind away from the system? So that's a sort of an entirely different possibility, which doesn't appeal to turbulence at all. Then for the more planet formation aspects, we're interested in how diffusive the turbulence is as far as particles are concerned. And then some other sorts of questions. Do we generate larger scale features in the turbulence, which I'll sort of be coming back to? Those could be also important for various problems, known problems in planet formation. And then on these smaller scales, do we meet these conditions for two fluid instabilities to start? And then if we do, what is their nonlinear outcome? Do they really lead to the formation of large objects like sort of asteroids or comet scale things? So I'm going to be discussing the aspects in red here. Mostly this is work that's being led by Chris Beckwith and Jake Simon, who are postdocs now in Colorado. So I'm going to go away from those very general considerations and just think about much more sort of limited aspect of the problem, thinking about MHD turbulence within disks. And the reason that people often consider MHD turbulence as being a sort of a central aspect of disks is that there's a known linear instability, the magnetorotational instability, which is extremely powerful if the disk only has weak magnetic fields in it. So roughly speaking, if the fields are subthermal compared to the gas pressure. So if you're in those conditions, and if the angular velocity decreases as you go further away from the central object, which it always will in a Keplerian potential, you have this local linear instability, which ultimately taps the free energy of the shear. And the interesting thing about it is that the growth rate is extremely fast. It's of order omega to the minus one, so it's dynamical timescale instability. And it operates on a range of scales, but the most unstable scales are typically a fraction of the disk scale height, so it's fairly macroscopic scale instability. And because it has this extremely fast growth rate, it's often thought to be the dominant driver of turbulence, unless either the disk is very massive, in which case then there are instabilities associated with self-gravity, which can certainly be competitive, or unless you manage to damp out MHD instabilities entirely by having a very large resistivity, for example, or some other non-ideal MHD effect. Now, protoplanetary disks, these non-ideal effects turn out to be actually very important. So this is sort of a caveat, because I'm going to basically be discussing ideal MHD later. So what's shown here is density.
Ideal, you mean the resistivity diffusion?
Yeah, resistivity and the polar diffusion and the Hall effect are the things we're interested in. So single fluid MHD approximation. So here's density temperature plane. And so this is sort of roughly covering the sort of regime I was mentioning as being interesting. So 10 to the minus 9 grams per cubic centimeter, which is sort of just a rough number, was here. Here's 100 Kelvin, wide range of density. And so, you know, with some approximations here, these are the different regimes in this parameter space where the different non-ideal effects are going to be most important. And so you have, and so then the tracks here show where a disk might fall in physical conditions as a function of distance from the star. So this is at the midplane. This would be very close to the star, going to quite far out. This green track would be in the disk atmosphere when you're several scale heights away from the midplane and the density is much lower. So at different points in the disk, you will sort of go between a whole range of different regimes. Generally close in, ideal MHD might be a reasonable approximation, and the first non-ideal term will be ohmic diffusion. If you go further out, the Hall effect will be very important. If you go to very low density regions, for example, well away from the midplane, then ambipolar diffusion will be important.
The density does not include the dust, or is that including dust?
This is the gas density only.
The gas density only.
So this is purely the relative ordering of these terms. So actually the dust will entirely determine, you know, how strong these are compared to induction.
Right.
So the overall situation is quite complicated. And at the moment I would say only the ideal MHD limit is even sort of close to being understood. So there's a lot, you know,
Does particles can carry charge?
Yes. So they could be important. They could be important charge carriers. And actually, another consideration is that metal ions can be important. They may not be in thermal equilibrium, and those are very important for recombination as well.
There could be. But it's not seen.
There's no observation.
Any flashes coming.
Yeah.
It would be real creation of planets.
So there is one thing you do see, which is that, you know, if you actually look at meteorites, you find that quite a lot of them have these little lumps in them, which are called chondrules. And so these are like little solid things about, you know, a millimeter or a few millimeters across. And the chemical evidence, the lab evidence, is that that's material that was sort of flash heated and cooled relatively quickly. It's actually lightning is one theory for how you make chondrules, but no one knows how you make chondrules.
I just thought about looking at the volcano in Iceland, which had a lot of lightning. Right?
So it could be.
Oh yeah, huge amount of lightning, the eruption.
So you can sort of look at this MHD turbulence in sort of different limits. So one aspect is to try and look at, you know, a fair fraction of the disk, a global calculation that includes the curvature terms, which are obviously potentially important. So we've done these kind of calculations. Other people have done these calculations, of course, as well. Here's an example. So this is a density rendering on the left. This would be the dense midplane. This is the lower density regions above. This is the plasma beta here, showing a sort of moderately magnetized midplane and a somewhat more magnetized region above and below the disk. So these are one class of simulations. Obviously, in these simulations especially, resolution is a huge challenge because you're trying to represent large spatial scales while also doing okay on the small scales. So for various reasons, we think something like 32 grid points per scale height is a minimum requirement for resolving the angular momentum transport in these kind of calculations. And in this sort of global model, we're only able to achieve that in a sort of narrow region near the disk midplane. So this is something that is still really...
So how expensive are these kind of simulations?
These would be maybe a million core hours, something like that.
A million core hours.
Yeah. Sorry. In the color bar, your maximum density is around 0.5, if I can see. Minimum density is around 10⁻⁴. And now if I compare it with the plot that you showed just in the last slide, you're still
order of magnitude. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so this is purely in code units. So this has been scaled.
How do you compare that? So
these are actually purely ideal MHD simulations. So the absolute density is arbitrary in that limit. So here we weren't even trying to do any non-ideal. And actually the only non-ideal physics we've done, which I won't describe today, is ohmic diffusion at the moment, ohmic dissipation. So an alternative method, which is sort of, you know, has obviously advantages and disadvantages, is to do local simulations rather than trying to model the whole disk. So the idea here is you take a patch of disk in R and azimuth and in height as well. And represent that with a local Cartesian coordinate system and linearize the shear about the, you know, midpoint value of this patch. So you can do that in different size volumes. We've gone up to this volume, so 16 scale heights radially, 32 azimuthally, 8 high. And, you know, within that patch, it's a shearing sheet, and the rotation is represented purely by the adding in the Coriolis force. So you're not fully representing the set of equations. But then if you do that, you know, you can, obviously it's a much simpler system. You can use quite simple boundary conditions. So in the azimuthal direction, you can be just periodic. In the vertical direction, you can be periodic or open or whatever you want. And then the key is in the radial direction, you use sliding periodic boundary conditions where, say, at time zero, you identify a point on the left with a point on the right. At some later time, you shift those, representing the difference in shear between the left and the right-hand sides of the domain.
And if you have strong turbulence, this patch will be strongly distorted, you know, and mixed with the environment in a pretty short time. No?
Right. So, you know, in this limit, you've removed the intrinsic asymmetry between inside and outside, because you just have linear shear, and you're making an assumption that, if you like, the most turbulent scales are contained within the box, right?
So you have open boundaries also at top and bottom for velocity?
So we tend to, in the ones I'm going to show, we have open boundary conditions.
That's how you are, because there's no problem with the period, because it looks like it's a homogeneous shear simulation, which was typically done by Rogallo and Spindler. So if I look at it, there is some problem, because if you say that at the top and bottom I have open boundary, so let's say there is a flux of velocity that can go out, then how I am going to map it back? I mean, after
right. So there's no mapping back here. So what you have is, you know, there's not much density at the boundary because it has basically a Gaussian density profile under vertical gravity. So there's not much material there. And so actually the main thing that happens, or the reason we have open boundaries, is mainly to allow magnetic flux to escape.
You can't run these these simulations for a long time, because your PVC at top wall will just keep on moving down. It will hit the bottom wall. I mean, the point which is at top will go on going down, hit the bottom wall, and then you can't continue your simulation because you don't know what is coming over from there.
I'm not sure I follow that. We should, like, yeah, you follow that. Right. So there is a possibility, obviously, that if mass was escaping, then obviously it would be just a rundown experiment. That there is some of that, but very little. There's some issues actually to discuss there. So, just show an example of what this looks like. This is actually not one of our recent simulations. It's a really old one with pencil. So this is radius, this is azimuth, this is height. You're looking at magnetic field here, and this is just the linear growth of the magneto-rotational instability. So initially it grows approximately axisymmetric in this case. Color here is, we're looking at magnetic field strength. So initially it develops axisymmetrically into a sort of channel flow, and then that breaks up into a turbulent flow on some number of orbits. So this doesn't, yeah.
It's ideal, so magnetic there is no magnetic diffusivity.
No magnetic diffusivity, just grid scale in this case. So that calculator, well, that movie was an old thing which was done with the pencil code. You may have recognized the rendering from that, which is sort of characteristic of pencil. We're actually now using the Athena code to do similar simulations. So this is unlike pencil, which is a high order finite difference code. This is a Godunov type numerical scheme using a different scheme for the magnetic field and parallelized also with MPI. And you know, we can get because we don't have to do Fourier transforms here. Actually, this scales very nicely on large systems. So this is a weak scaling test on the Kraken system, which is one of the larger systems available in the US. This goes up to about 10 to the 5 cores, and you can get actually quite good scaling with not too large individual tiles. So this is 64 cubed tiles per processor. Nix, so it's Tennessee, Kraken. I don't know that number. I mean, it's certainly not better than 10%. Then this is much larger than the number of cores we actually are using. We're actually using about 2,000 cores on most of these things. This was like a test for Blue Waters. So the things we've been looking at with these simulations are some sort of basic things to do, first of all, with convergence. So the plot on the left is a convergence study done by Davis, Stone, and Pessar, varying the resolution of the simulations in a fixed spatial domain. Okay, so the black curve here is the highest resolution, that's 128 grid zones per scale height. The blue is the lowest resolution, that's 32 zones per scale height, and the quantity that's being plotted here is the angular momentum transport efficiency, the stress. This is a function of orbital time. This is up to 300 orbits. So you can see there's a lot of variation in this case in the stress, but it does appear that one is converging on the answer for the correct angular momentum transport efficiency at these sort of resolutions with this physical setup. Then the plot on the right is sort of the same sort of thing with fixed resolution but varying the domain size. So going from a small patch to much larger patches, so 0.5 scale heights radially up to 16 scale heights radially. And again, this is a slightly different measure. This is the ratio of the Maxwell stress to the fluid stress. But again, you can see this actually converges quite well with increasing the domain size. So that aspect appears to be under reasonably good control. Now, something sort of science aspect we're trying to look at with those same calculations is to compare with observations. And actually, there is a recent claim just over the last year or so for a measurement of the turbulent velocity within protoplanetary disks. And the way the measurement is done is to look at molecular mine profiles in carbon monoxide. So it's a particular transition of the carbon monoxide molecule, and it's observed in the submillimeter radio bands. And so what's shown on the top here is the line profile as a function of a frequency here measured in intensity of this line as a function of frequency, or measured here in velocity units. So the data is this noisy black curve, and then there are three models here, and there's a suggestion that the model that has turbulence, which are the blue and the red, represent a better fit to this data than the model that is purely laminar flow.
Distribution of radius. What is horizontal scale?
Horizontal is frequency.
It's frequency.
Observed frequency. So this is really the observation. And so, okay, and then these things here are showing like what the images would look like at different.
Does Doppler shift? How turbulence changes the frequency profile?
So it would broaden it more than the Doppler shift. It would kind of give additional broadening beyond just the mean rotation speed. So for the moment, this is only a moderately significant detection. This is formally about three sigma, and you can sort of see, you might say that the black curve there that has no turbulence is a not bad fit to the data already. So it's not tremendously significant. But if it is correct, it implies velocities in the region where this particular transition is emitted of about a few tenths of the sound speed. And something that's sort of interesting is that this is with existing instrumentation. There's a very large new radio telescope that's under construction now in the Atacama Desert, which will be about an order of magnitude better at this kind of observation than what we have today. So this should be a test in the future. And if you ask, well, is that at all consistent with what you might expect? It actually is consistent with what you might expect. So in these ideal MHD calculations, it's the distribution function of what would be the observed velocity, the line of sight projection of the velocity, for gas at different heights above the midplane of the disk. So the blue curve is just average mass weighted over the whole fluid, and then the curves to the right are more and more concentrated towards the disk atmosphere. And so you see that as you go to the atmosphere, you get much larger turbulent velocities. Those are more magnetically dominated regions, you get larger fluid velocities taking place there. And the observationally measured value of about 0.4 sound speed would actually be consistent with what is expected close to the skin of the disk, which is where these lines are believed to be being produced. So it may be possible, in the next 2 or 3 years to turn this from being just a 3 sigma observation, and it sort of roughly matches the theory, into a more quantitative match. Okay, so let me now discuss the things that we don't understand about these simulations. So one which has been known about for a long time is to do with the organization of the magnetic field that develops. So this is again from this Davis paper from last year, but this has been known about for longer. So what you're looking at here is the azimuthal average of the magnetic field, the toroidal magnetic field, as a function of height above the midplane of the disk. So the midplane would be in the middle. And then the x-axis here is time. So this is a space-time diagram. And the colors are showing magnetic field strength. And the two different panels are just different size domains. So otherwise, they're the same. And so what you see is that there's this sort of cycle in which, if you look sort of one scale height above the midplane, it seems that magnetic flux of a particular sign, toroidal magnetic flux of a particular sign, is being generated, and then it's sort of rising out of the disk, and then being replaced by magnetic flux of the opposite sign. And this is happening on a sort of periodic basis. So it's a little bit like what is seen on the sun when you see this butterfly diagram of sunspots. And here it's again, related to magnetic field strengths.
Isn't there an atomic dynamo for this?
That's basically the question. Can this be interpreted in an alpha omega dynamo sense? I mean, certainly it seems that, so the periodicity here is of order 10 orbits or 20 orbits, and this appears to be very, very robust. So it appears to be, you could do different aspects of physics, different domains, and so on, you always get pretty much the same answer. So there seems to be something that is setting this sort of clock of 10 or 20 orbits, and it seems to be very generic to the system. So here's one question, you know, what is really setting this timescale, and you know, how do we interpret that in terms of a simpler model? Now, possibly related to that, but possibly not, is the question of temporal convergence, the convergence of the temporal properties of the turbulence. So this is now back to our own shearing box simulations in different size boxes. So here, the black is the smallest box. Actually, there are smaller ones, but this is the smallest one plotted. Then we have the red, the blue, and the sort of purple color. And those are increasingly large domains at fixed resolution. And so what you see is that as you go to these larger boxes, the temporal variability, this is in the stress again, goes down. You could plot other quantities. And it goes down by more, actually much more, than simply, you know, averaging independent patches. So it's not just, well, you've got, you know, more statistics, so you're obviously beating down the noise. Actually, you're going down by more than, you know, square root of n type considerations. So for some reason, although the sort of small-scale properties, things like the stress itself and things like that, appear to converge quite nicely, the variability is not converging in the same way. It's actually becoming less variable in a sort of some way that we're not really understanding very well.
I mean, the highest resolution is the purple one, right?
So the highest resolution is the purple one. And you actually,
oscillates.
Yeah, so the purple one is actually doing something. I can show you what the purple one is doing in a minute. The purple one actually has some other
issues.
Other issues. Some other large-scale structures developing there that's not just, you know, not just noise.
So there's some
coupling here, and we think this has probably got something to do, in fact, with the previous problem or the previous issue about the butterfly diagram. It's probably related to the net toroidal field. But you know, actually, the magnitude of the net toroidal field is quite similar in the different rounds. So it's not obvious what is going on. Okay, so that was magnetic field and temporal aspects. Now, something else which is also a question of convergence, but also maybe of actually more physical importance for planet formation, is the formation of large-scale structures in the density and in the azimuthal velocity field. So here are three plots. Again, the time on the x-axis is now density. And going top to bottom, all we're doing is increasing the size of the domain again. So it's a narrow radial domain at the top, down to one that's 8 scale heights wide at the bottom. And in a narrow domain, you can see the density is sort of fairly uniform, doesn't seem to have very much structure.
What's the difference between top and bottom? What's the difference between this?
The box is bigger.
Just size.
Okay, so I mean, everything's scaled here, but yeah, the box is bigger. So in a small box, the density is pretty uniform. Okay?
The aspect ratio is the same.
Actually, well, so the aspect ratio in R and phi is the same. The height is absolutely fixed because that's, you know, set by the gravity, and the resolution is the same.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So as you go to larger boxes, you go from like having quite uniform density to starting to have these sort of peaks of density. Like a one sine wave of density within the box. And as you go from a sort of smallish box to a somewhat larger box, the scale of that structure just appears to grow to fill the box. Okay, so it's not being resolved. And so this is a perturbation. This is density. This is also a perturbation in azimuthal velocity. So everything is in pressure equilibrium regularly. And so these are sometimes called zonal flows. They were discussed a couple of years ago. And they appear again to be quite generic features of what's happening. So here's just another representation of it. Here in the correlation function of the density. So here I've explicitly shown how big the box is. So you know, the density field is in general correlated or decorrelates on quite a short length scale, much smaller, significantly smaller than the disk scale height. So it has like a peak at zero here. And in a small box, that's all you see. But as you go to a bigger box, you get this big stripe here at lower values of correlation, which is this zonal flow developing in the larger simulation. Okay, so this is the largest box we've done. So this is now 16 scale heights wide and 32 scale heights in azimuth. This actually goes out somewhat further than this being shown here. And what we find in the largest box is that there's a sort of hint that one's maybe seeing a physical scale emerging. So this is the power spectrum in the radial direction in these different size boxes getting larger here. And so as you go up to the second largest box, you're just getting, you know, all the power essentially going to the largest scale you have available. When you go to the very largest one, it's sort of roughly flat between the first and the second modes.
It's a density spectrum of a...
This is density.
Is there any scaling?
Depends on your eyes, right?
Well, it's about the
degree. Really used, I mean, right?
Come on, guys. Do scale.
I know.
Down here, it is roughly what you expect for incompressible. So there's a hint here, and only a hint, that, you know, we're starting to see a physical scale for how large these phenomena might be. And it might be of order 8 or 10, let's say 10 scale heights.
How does energy flow in these systems? Are there turbulence? So what is the energy spectrum? Where does the energy go? I mean, how does it flow? Does it go from small to large,
or actually
small?
It's shear generated, probably. Plus
principally,
gravity, plus compressible component is complicated.
So it's principally.
Completely 3D.
So it's principally going. It's principally going to small scales, but it's being driven, I think, at quite a broad range of scales.
But there's no inverse cascade. No.
Oh, absolutely. There must be inverse cascade on the scales. Comparable to the depth of the disk, all this creates this type of zonal flow that you see. There's a large scale structures which are creating some kind of inverse.
So
I don't think there is much
scale separation.
Much scale separation, but it's a kind of interesting system.
So let me just finish by just sort of noting. Why are we particularly interested in this aspect, this large-scale aspect? So obviously, there are many other aspects that we've also been interested in. For example, the growth of large-scale magnetic field is also obviously very, very interesting. However, for planet formation, we're particularly interested in this density aspect because there's a very long-standing problem in planet formation, which is sometimes called the radial drift problem. And it's very simple physics indeed. If you think about the gas within the disk, the gas is partially supported against gravity by a radial pressure gradient. So although, to order h over r squared, it's just orbiting at the Keplerian velocity, actually it's orbiting slightly slower because pressure is providing a little bit of the support against gravity. So the gas is orbiting sub-Keplerian velocity, whereas, a boulder, like a meter-sized boulder in that disk, would just be going around at the Keplerian velocity. So the particle, boulder in this case, will be moving faster than the gas and will feel aerodynamic headwind. And so there will be just nothing to do with turbulence here. There will just be a loss of angular momentum and a decay of the orbit of the particle due to transfer of angular momentum into the gas. And you can work out how quick that is in terms of the friction time, which is like a characteristic time for the boulder to lose its linear momentum due to aerodynamic forces. And you get this expression for the radial velocity. It depends on eta here, which is just how sub-Keplerian the gas is, which in turn depends on how thick it is. Eta is a parameter of order, h over r squared. So it's a very simple formula, and it's purely aerodynamic drag, so there's no complicated physics at all, and it's a problem because the predicted timescale is extremely fast. So here's a calculation of that. So this is the radial velocity as a fraction of the orbital velocity as a function of this friction time. So one is a critically coupled particle that would lose all its relative velocity on just one orbital period. And what you see is that when you're close to this critical coupling, which would correspond to particle sizes of centimeters or meters, the radial velocity is somewhere between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 2 of the orbital velocity. So in 100 or 1,000 orbits, you'd expect the particle to just spiral in to the star. And that's what's shown here. This is the drift time as a function of radius. These are for different particle sizes. The point to note here is just the timescale is very, very short. It's 1,000 years or 10,000 years. So what this says is if you sort of somehow build things that are a meter in size in a protoplanetary disk, you're going to lose them, essentially 100% of them, on a very, very short timescale into the star. So clearly that can't happen very much, right? There must be some way of stopping this or somehow avoiding this problem in the first place.
Well, I mean, the question is, when you say quantum happens, perhaps it happens most of the time, and sometimes it doesn't. How do you know it's quantum? I mean, it could happen most of the times, and the few planetary systems we see, it didn't happen by some.
Right, but you know, so we have a lower limit on the number of planets of, you know, of order 10% from direct observations, and it's probably much higher than that. Now, you know, but you're right, of course, that if you ask, you know, how much solid material is in the planets compared to how much solid material was in the disk that formed the planets, the answer is a very small amount. I mean, most of the solid material that was in the protoplanetary disk is now in the sun. Right, so. Having some of this is fine, but you just don't want
to.
You don't want too much, exactly. So, one explanation for this, which goes back to those two fluid instabilities we were mentioning at the start, is that perhaps in fact you never had particles that were a meter in size in the gas disk. Maybe you went straight from millimeter-sized objects to kilometer-sized objects, and you just jumped over this region where aerodynamic coupling is very strong. So one way to do that is, you know, take the millimeter-sized objects,
cluster them
very strongly, they collapse under gravity to build an asteroid, right? And then everything happens far too quickly for this to ever matter. So that's one possibility. The other possibility, however, is, you know, maybe it's got something to do, so that would be the word to do with the self-generated turbulence due to the two fluids. Another possibility is maybe it's to do with the intrinsic turbulence and this kind of zonal flow. And so the way that would work is that I said the radial drift is inwards, but generically that's because the gas is going at a subcaplerian rate, and that's because the pressure is decreasing outwards. So if you instead create an axisymmetric pressure profile, so this pressure is a function of radius, that has a local peak, then particles will drift in towards that peak from the outside, but when you're in this sort of rising part, they'll move towards the peak from the inside. So having structure in the turbulence, if it's strong enough on the right scales, will actually trap particles and prevent this radial drift happening at all. So another possibility is that this is what you're doing. And so if this is what's happening, you know, you don't actually stop radial drift entirely, because, you know, these density maxima come and go in the turbulence, but you basically go from having a sort of linear drift of particles inwards to a sort of turbulent diffusion, because particles are trapped in the maxima for some period of time, the maxima vanishes, they start drifting, they can get trapped again, and so on. So you could have a situation where maybe, you know, you just, most of the particles are lost, but you have a much longer persistence time at the rare events. So that's what we're looking at there. So let me just finish there, and I think that just says what we've been talking about. Thank you.